Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. On the record, new audio recordings reveal the president admitting to misleading the American people about the severity of COVID-19. Then the West Coast is burning. High winds fan the flames of uncontrolled fires across the region as all national forests in California are closed and more power outages are expected. Plus, matters of justice. The federal government moves to defend the president against a 25-year-old rape allegation, moving the case to federal court. And the racial divide. COVID-19 hits communities of color hardest in the U.S., furthering already stark inequalities.
They have higher risk because of the work that they're doing. They have higher risk because they have to take public transport. They have higher risk because they're living in crowded conditions.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A new political firestorm has broken out at the White House tonight as wildfires ravage much of the West Coast. First, to what the president knew and what he said publicly as the COVID-19 pandemic began. It's recounted in a new book by Bob Woodward. John Yang begins our coverage.
In a recorded interview on February 7th, before the full effect of the coronavirus in the United States was publicly clear, President Trump told Washington Post editor Bob Woodward that he knew it was deadlier than the flu.
You just breathe the air. That's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus. This is more deadly. This is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff.
That stands in stark contrast with his public statements at the time. This is the president 3 days after that interview.
Looks like by April, you know, in theory, when it gets a little warmer, it miraculously goes away. I hope that's true.
In March, President Trump told Woodward he was deliberately downplaying the coronavirus's seriousness.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
Campaigning in Warren, Michigan, Democratic nominee Joe Biden weighed in.
He knowingly and willingly lied about the threat it posed to the country for months. He had the information. He knew how dangerous it was. And while this deadly disease ripped through our nation, he failed to do his job on purpose. It was a life and death betrayal of the American people.
President Trump defended his comments at a White House event to name potential future Supreme Court nominees.
The fact is, I'm a cheerleader for this country. I love our country. And I don't want people to be frightened. I don't want to create panic, as you say. And certainly, I'm not going to drive this country or the world into a frenzy. We want to show confidence. We want to show strength. We want to show strength as a nation.
According to a new NBC News Marist poll out today, Biden is leading President Trump in Pennsylvania by 9 points, and in Florida, the two are in a virtual tie. And on Tuesday, the Trump campaign announced that in August, it had raised $210 million jointly with the Republican National Committee. That's their best month to date, but still well below Biden and the Democratic National Committee's $364 million in August. On Thursday, President Trump hits the trail himself, heading to Michigan. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
And for more about Bob Woodward's new book, we are joined now by Washington Post reporter and moderator of PBS's Washington Week, Robert Costa. Bob Costa, thank you so much for talking with us. You were just telling me you've read the book, you've listened to much of the audio recordings provided by Bob Woodward. How much does he say the president knew about this virus in late January, early February?
He knew a lot, Judy. And Woodward recounts how, based on his reporting, President Trump was told on January 28th of this year by his top national security officials, Robert O'Brien and Matthew Pottinger, that the pandemic, the coronavirus, was the gravest national security threat he has yet seen in his presidency. Pottinger compared it to the 1918 flu pandemic, which killed millions worldwide. And then just a few days later, the president, who had been continuing to be briefed, he told Woodward that the virus is very deadly. And you saw that in the clip shown by John Yang.
And we just showed, Bob, a portion of what the president was saying in public at that time. But what was the contrast then between what the president knew, what he was sharing with Bob Woodward, and what he was saying to the American people?
So one thing that comes through in Woodward's book, Rage, is that it's Dr. Fauci, it's Dr. Redfield at the CDC, it's Matthew Pottinger, Robert O'Brien, a whole galaxy of national security and health officials are telling the president of the United States in January, February, and March that this pandemic is deadly, it's only going to grow in scope, it's not going to disappear, and they're urging drastic action, dramatic and sweeping action. Yet, as we all know, that action is not taken really until March in many states in terms of shutting down businesses and having people stay in their homes and social distance. The president was even thinking about having rallies at the same time he was being briefed about the seriousness of the virus. And he kept telling the American people that this virus would go away. It's comparable or even not that bad compared to the seasonal flu. Yet officials behind the scenes were telling the president a different story. And Woodward was talking to the president simultaneously and hearing that real story from President Trump.
And according to Woodward's book, the president was also relating his conversations with China's President Xi Jinping, who was sharing some of the seriousness. Of course, the president later went on to be very critical of President Xi. But Bob, what about the president's defense today, that he was doing this for a reason? He didn't want to frighten the American people.
Well, that was the president's defense. He said he did not want to create a panic. And the president told Woodward in March of this year that he has deliberately played down the pandemic as a threat for that exact reason he stated today. He does not want to create a panic. As a reporter, it's not for me to say how the American people will judge this, but this comes less than 2 months before the presidential election. And you now have a president on tape. It's unprecedented to have this kind of Woodward-style interview, a series of presidential interviews on tape this close to an election about the biggest issue of this presidential season, the pandemic. And the book goes on in many other ways about North Korea, about the president's flippant remarks, Woodward's terms, in terms of how he discussed race, how he discussed President Obama, Senator Harris, et cetera.
It is remarkable, and we don't have time to get into all of that, but you're right, Bob. There were just stunning comments from people who were high up in the Trump administration before they left. James Mattis, the former defense secretary, Dan Coats, the former head of national intelligence. All of this adds up to a fairly damning picture.
It's a picture that Woodward concludes shows that President Trump, in his words, is the wrong man for the job. And Woodward, who has spent a career reporting on the presidency and often has distance, he still has distance in the way he writes this book, but he has an assessment at the end of the book, saying the president, based on his own experience of interviewing him and watching him, is the wrong man for the job. That's Bob Woodward's statement, the final sentence, actually, of his own book. This book, so late in his career, he is saying to the American people, here's what I know, here's what I think. And he's also providing the tapes, something going back to Watergate with Woodward, the Nixon era, so famous for the tapes inside the White House, the tapes once again becoming an issue in American politics.
And just, again, so many things to bring out. But, Bob, one other thing that stood out to me was his comments praising the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, describing how smart he was, far beyond smart. It stands out how he praises someone like the North Korean leader.
And we've seen in your own reporting, Judy, and others at PBS, the relationship between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. But what Woodward does is add detail, and he shows how Kim Jong-un, this dictator, is writing about to President Trump about their relationship, calling it akin to a fantasy film, that it's this wonderful thing. It's a precious thing they want to preserve. And Woodward challenges to appoint President Trump on these issues. And he says, well, what's this all about, all this flowery language? And President Trump curses in the course of several interviews, saying, it's no big deal. And you can guess the phrase he used. And he said, I was just trying to meet with him, just trying to keep the peace. But there's this unusual, to say the least, rapport between a dictator and the president of the United States on page through letters.
Just a lot of material here that I know we'll continue to report on. But Bob Costa, thank you very much for being with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And now to the West Coast, where blowtorch winds sent wildfires racing anew today. Oregon's governor reported hundreds of homes had burned, and California struggled again to corral fires up and down the state. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
Heavy winds and low humidity. The day's forecast brought fresh dangers to much of California, where smoke from 24 active fires blotted out the sun in the Bay Area, turning the skies an eerie orange.
All the windows are open in my house, and look how dark it is. This is crazy.
In central California, the Creek Fire, among the biggest in the state, is still raging completely unchecked. Authorities say it has burned more than 360 buildings and is threatening 5,000 more around the Sierra National Forest east of Fresno. All national forests were closed down statewide today to prevent other fires from erupting. Farther north, another fire rapidly exploded overnight in Butte County, which led to evacuation orders and warnings, including for the town of Paradise, which was decimated by the state's deadliest wildfire in 2018. More than 2 million acres have been burned in fires across California, an unprecedented amount this early in the season. But the National Weather Service is warning of elevated fire risk in much of the western U.S. Oregon is dealing with at least 35 active fires. Thousands have been ordered to evacuate, and a state of emergency was declared overnight. Satellite imagery shows the staggering amount of smoke from fires there and in California. In Washington state, wildfires burned more acres in a single day than normally seen in a full year. Crews in Washington battled through the smoke-filled skies overnight. Much of the devastation centered around the small farming town of Malden in the eastern part of the state.
Everything gone. Clothes, beds, everything.
About 80% of homes and structures were destroyed. Strong winds are also driving fires in other parts of the drought-stricken West, from Arizona to Montana. Still, crews in some regions got a moment of respite. A drastic temperature plunge around Denver, Colorado yesterday brought with it snow, helping contain fires there.
Had a little unexpected weather roll in. Weather in the 80s yesterday and now in the 20s today.
Extreme weather and extreme fires. But back in California, there's reason to hope for a break.
The wind activity appears to be dying down, which is encouraging. And the rest of the week looks a little bit more favorable.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
In the day's other news, more than 3,500 people were left with virtually nothing after their refugee camp in Greece burned overnight. The camp on the island of Lesbos housed some 12,000 asylum seekers and already faced an outbreak of COVID-19. We'll get details later in the program. The United Nations has issued a new climate warning that could mean more natural disasters and extreme weather. A new report says the world is now nearly 2 degrees warmer than during pre-industrial times. The targeted ceiling is 2.7 degrees under the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. The report says that the world may pass that ceiling within a decade. The head of the U.S. National Institutes of Health insisted today that there will be no compromise on safety with a coronavirus vaccine. Just yesterday, drug maker AstraZeneca paused late-stage trials for a leading vaccine candidate when a participant developed an unexplained illness. At a Senate hearing today, NIH Director Francis Collins said the pause proves that safety overrides everything, including politics.
I can't say strongly enough that the decisions about how this vaccine is going to be evaluated and assessed is going to be based on science. And I know I speak for my colleagues in the government and certainly for the scientific community broadly, that that can be the only basis upon which this decision is made. Otherwise, the public would not be expected to trust us.
President Trump has talked of getting a vaccine before the November election, but Collins said that no one can predict that. The United States is withdrawing more than 40% of its remaining troops from Iraq this month. The top American commander in the Middle East, Marine General Frank McKenzie, said today that the number will drop from 5,200 to 3,000. He said Iraqis are now able to deal with Islamic State militants on their own. Afghanistan's first vice president narrowly escaped being assassinated in Kabul today. At least 10 others died and more than 30 were wounded. Officials said that a bomb was hidden in a cart along the roadside and exploded as the vice president's convoy passed. He later posted a video message about the attack.
A huge and horrific explosion targeted our convoy while we were driving to work. A number of my brave bodyguards were wounded. Me and my son sustained some minor burns on our faces, and my hand was slightly injured because the explosion was very strong and melted the windows of the vehicle.
The Taliban denied that it carried out the attack as it gets ready for expected peace talks with the Afghan government. Back in this country, a former federal Homeland Security official, Brian Murphy, says that he was told to manipulate intelligence to benefit President Trump politically. He says that top Homeland Security and White House officials wanted to play down Russian interference in U.S. elections and play up Chinese and Iranian meddling, among other things. The claims are in a whistleblower complaint released by the House Intelligence Committee. The White House today denied any improper influence on intelligence. And on Wall Street, tech stocks managed to stop the bleeding, at least for a day, and the broader market rallied. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 439 points to close at 27,940. The Nasdaq rose nearly 294 points, and the S&P 500 added 67. That's his best day in 3 months. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Justice Department gets involved in the case of a rape allegation against the president. A major fire destroys Europe's largest migrant camp on the Greek island of Lesbos. How to teach a new generation practical skills, working with their hands, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Last night's move by the Department of Justice to intervene in a lawsuit against President Trump has critics of the administration crying foul. William Brangham begins our coverage of the unusual legal filing.
In Chicago today, Attorney General William Barr defended the Justice Department's latest move to shield the president from legal exposure.
So this was a normal application of the law. The law is clear. It is done frequently.
Last night, the DOJ asked to take over as President Trump's defense in a defamation lawsuit filed by a woman who accused the president of raping her many years ago. In 2019, advice columnist E. Jean Carroll alleged that in the 1990s, then-businessman Donald Trump raped her in a New York City department store dressing room. The Justice Department's move would shift the venue from New York's Supreme Court to federal court and substitute in the U.S. government as the defendant instead of Mr. Trump. That would mean the federal government, rather than the president, would be on the hook to pay any financial damages the president's accuser might be awarded. For his part, President Trump has repeatedly denied Carroll's allegations.
So it's a total false accusation, and I don't know anything about her.
But Carroll says the president's words harmed her reputation and career, and so she sued for defamation. Carroll's lawyer called last night's filing by the DOJ, quote, shocking. Today, Attorney General Barr argued the law entitles elected officials to a federal defense when they make public comments, even if the comments concern their personal life. This isn't the first time the Attorney General has inserted himself into a politically fraught investigation connected to the president. Barr overruled prosecutors and tried to reduce the prison sentence of Trump ally Roger Stone, who was convicted of lying to congressional investigators. President Trump later commuted Stone's sentence. And this year, the DOJ also moved to dismiss its own case against former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn.
For a closer look at all of this, I'm joined now by David Loffman. He held senior roles at the U.S. Department of Justice during the George W. Bush and Obama administrations. He's now an attorney in private practice. David Loffman, very good to have you here. Could you just help us understand how unprecedented is this move that we saw from Attorney General Barr last night?
I mean, I can't think of anything historically that is comparable to this, where the Department of Justice is coming to the rescue of a president in connection with his public comments about private behavior many years ago and alleged sexual assault. And in and of itself, it ought to shock the conscience of all Americans who care about the Department of Justice's essential role as an independent arbiter of the rule of law.
Well, help me understand this, because as we just heard from Attorney General Barr, he says this happens all the time. He, in the press conference, also said that other presidents, vice presidents, have done this, that this is not unusual at all.
I mean, this is not a case of the likes of which he's probably referring, where at issue is whether a president or executive branch official has truly acted within the scope of their official duties. The president's, you know, comments about a rape assault allegation just don't squarely come within the scope of his official duties. It's shocking that the Department of Justice and the Attorney General would say so, and I'd be stunned if a district court found so.
Yeah, this was one of the arguments that the Department of Justice was making, which was that when the president said those things, denying the assault allegations and the things he said about Mrs. Carroll, that he was acting in his role as president, thus it's appropriate for the DOJ to make this move. You think that that assertion is false?
I don't think that that is a version of the president's protection from liability that will square with how the courts have historically addressed these issues.
So are there other historical comparisons? I mean, I think back to, say, when Bill Clinton was in office and he was going through the Paula Jones case. I certainly don't remember the Department of Justice stepping in and saying, we will handle your defense and we ought to take this on as the U.S. government.
It would never have entered Bill Clinton's mind. It would never have entered the Attorney General's mind. He had private counsel to represent him throughout that debacle. And look, I mean, this is the latest in a rogues gallery of other examples where the Department of Justice, in the hands particularly of this Attorney General, has been weaponized in furtherance of the president's personal and political ends and not in his essential role as an independent arbiter of the rule of law.
You worked in the Department of Justice. You know a lot of the rank and file there. We know the president has had a very complicated, is probably the most generous way to put it, complicated relationship with the DOJ and the Justice Department. What are staff lawyers and attorneys and people within the DOJ feeling about this? Do they think this is appropriate? Do you hear from them? What are you hearing?
Well, I'll just say that I think it's reasonable for the American people to believe that these types of events are jarring to the rank and file men and women of the Department of Justice, career attorneys, FBI agents, law enforcement agents across the country who day to day, you know, put their nose to the grindstone to carry out the rule of law in an impartial fashion without fear or favor and without the need to fear improper political influence. It doesn't make their jobs any easier. And if you think about trials and proceedings across the country that take place in courts across this country, you know, when an assistant U.S. attorney stands up on behalf of the United States, when an FBI agent takes the witness stand, what are jurors to think now? What credibility can they attach to the government? Is it always going to be the same? Is that credibility and trust going to be eroded? That's among the greatest fears that I and other former Department of Justice officials have.
Can we go back to the Carroll case at hand here? What does it actually mean that the president, again, this is if the DOJ's movement is successful, and we don't know that yet, but the president no longer is the defendant. Now the U.S. government is the defendant. That means the DOJ lawyers will now be working on the president's defense. Is that what happens if they're successful?
If they're successful, my understanding as a matter of law, in essence, is that it will bring the case to an end because the United States government can't be sued for defamation. So it will have the de facto effect of bringing this case to an end, to protecting the president from the type of embarrassment and potentially the liability that he could incur if this case moves forward on its previous course.
I mean, we knew that the president had lost his appeal in New York State to delay this case and that he was on the cusp, perhaps, of having to do a sworn interview about this case, to perhaps even give a DNA sample to Ms. Carroll's lawyers. Do you think that the timing of this is suspect in that sense, that that's clearly why the attorney general has stepped forward to act now?
I can't speak to any motives or intentions that Ms. Carroll had with respect to the timing of this lawsuit, but that should have nothing to do with the appropriate use of the Department of Justice as an instrument of the president's personal, petty, you know, political or personal grievances. It's just completely inappropriate.
All right. David Loftman, who used to hold senior positions at the DOJ, thank you very much for your time and helping us wade through all of this.
Thank you for having me.
Fire ripped through the Moria refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos last night and reignited today. The camp was overcrowded and unsanitary, but it was the only place its thousands of inhabitants called home. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabant visited Moria earlier this year and has this report.
Along with his fellow asylum seekers, Fahim Ibrahimi from Afghanistan lost everything in the flames.
Me, how is this finished? As far as many, all finished.
Moria was Europe's largest and most notorious refugee camp. It was supposed to house 2,000, but 13,000 lived in squalid conditions in and outside the barbed wire. Now they're all more destitute than ever.
Our house is burning, you know, our food is burning. Everything, our money is gone. We don't know what will happen.
Now, we will sleep on the street. What can we do? We don't have food. We don't have anything. What can we do?
Morning revealed the true extent of this catastrophe. The fire began after midnight when a group protested against new coronavirus restrictions. So far, 35 migrants have tested positive for COVID. They were obliged to isolate, and there were fears that other migrants could end up in detention.
They thought, okay, everything is a mess right now. They wanted to put us in jail, all of us in the camp. They want to put fence around, finish. We don't want to be there, and they start burning things. And I think, no, it started maybe with one fire, and it went crazy. People just got enough.
Salam al-Din runs a non-profit called Team Humanity that helps Moria's occupants. Aldeen says his volunteers went into the camp to help save people. So far, no deaths have been reported. There was anger that police stopped the refugees from reaching nearby Mytilene. The Greeks have effectively placed the camp in quarantine because they don't want the virus spreading.
The police have blocked the road, the entry, actually the road to the city. They blocked it in front of my center. They don't want the refugees to go there.
The relationship between islanders and refugees has frequently been fractious. There's been a campaign to remove the asylum seekers to the mainland. The conditions in Moria have consistently been condemned as inhumane. Greece has long complained that it's unable to cope with tens of thousands of asylum seekers, some of whom have been stuck in the country for years. It has appealed for international help after the fire, and Germany has responded.
Now is the time to define together with the Greeks what kind of help is needed. We will then evaluate this request and then assist quickly and straightforwardly. We have helped Greece many times in the past, and of course we will do so now.
The disaster has exacerbated tensions between the islanders and their unwanted neighbors. The UN Refugee Agency has appealed to the migrants to stay close to the remains of the camp, while efforts are made to find them new accommodation. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant.
A new poll of America's four largest cities underscores the disproportionate economic impact of the pandemic on Black and Latino Americans. The poll of residents in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Houston found at least half of all residents either lost a job or lost wages or hours. But the percentage of residents with financial problems soared above 70% for Black and Latino residents in some cities. The poll was conducted by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, NPR, and the Harvard School of Public Health. The foundation is a funder of the NewsHour. Yamiche Alcindor has a report on the connections between the health crisis and the economic impact on Black and Latino Americans.
In April, after a trip to a crowded local supermarket in Northern Virginia, Maria Zelaya felt sick. The 45-year-old came down with symptoms that sounded a lot like the one she'd heard on TV.
Dolor de cabeza.
I got a headache, body aches, and the following day my throat hurt. It was hard to swallow and I lost my appetite. I just wanted to stay in bed.
Her test came back positive for COVID-19, and she was told she needed to self-isolate. That was easier said than done for Zelaya, who immigrated from El Salvador in 2003 and works as a dishwasher. She shares a two-bedroom apartment with her three daughters, as well as a friend and her friend's daughters.
I was afraid for myself, for my girls, for everyone who lives in the house. We live in an apartment that's very small, and there's seven of us. That's a lot. But this is the reality we Latinos and immigrants live with right now.
Just across the river in southeast Washington, D.C., Cecil Brown and his fiancée, Shanrika, who didn't want to use her last name, are just now recovering from COVID-19. Both have lost family members and friends to the virus and say there were some dark moments along the way.
I'm a diabetic, have hypertension. So it was just like I was seeing myself on ventilators. I was just thinking the worst.
Shanrika works at the front desk of a mental health center in Washington, and she says there were not enough protections to keep her from catching the virus there in July. Soon after, Cecil began showing symptoms too.
I just didn't feel that she was in a safe environment. Then she gets it, and then she brings it to me. So I was angry. I was really, really angry.
Together, these two stories help explain what's driving a national trend. According to a recent New York Times analysis of federal data, African Americans and Latinos have been disproportionately hit by COVID-19. They're three times as likely to contract coronavirus as whites, and nearly twice as likely to die from it.
You know, ultimately, economic issues are what's driving the impact of the virus in low-income and minority communities.
Dr. Bassem Khan is the executive director of Neighborhood Health, a chain of clinics in Northern Virginia serving 30,000 residents. Many of them are immigrants who lack health insurance. Since the outbreak, his clinics have ramped up free testing to try to identify and contain the spread. They have seen the startling pattern play out. While Hispanic residents make up 50% of their patient population, they account for 90% of the positive tests.
They have higher risk because of the work that they're doing. They have higher risk because they have to take public transport. They have higher risk because they're living in crowded conditions. And the reason they're living in crowded conditions is they can't afford enough to live in areas like Northern Virginia or the District of Columbia.
In this area, the median home price is about double the national average. So many low-wage earners in fields like construction, healthcare, grocery stores, and restaurants also live in crowded homes where infections can spread easily.
And ultimately, that's what's really driven the epidemic in these communities.
While Latino residents have been hit hard in Northern Virginia, in Washington, D.C., African Americans are getting slammed by the virus. The district has seen more than 14,000 positive cases of COVID-19. Half of those have been among African Americans, making them more than twice as likely as white residents to catch it. And despite making up less than half of the city's population, they've accounted for three quarters of the city's deaths.
If the pandemic was looking for the perfect place to strike, to ravage through like a wildfire, it found us.
Troy Prestwood is a neighborhood commissioner for Ward 8 in southeast Washington, D.C., where a third of families live below the poverty line. The ward leads the city in rates of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and other conditions. And now it has the highest number of deaths from COVID-19, too. One of them was Curtis Orr, a 55-year-old immigrant from Trinidad who started his own dental business. He was Troy Presswood's cousin.
He simply was a working man. He had a staff that was also working, and he was doing the right thing, living the American dream. And he got sick, like so many other people.
Why do you think more Black people are dying of the coronavirus, especially here in Southeast DC?
It's because Southeast DC has often been left behind.
He says that like Latinos in Northern Virginia, many African Americans here work in jobs they just can't do from home, depend on public transportation to get around, and live in multi-generational homes. And he said some in the community have become complacent about wearing face masks and social distancing. With only one grocery store in the entire ward, many depend on corner stores and fast food, high in salt, sugar, and fat. That combination of higher infection rates and higher rates of underlying health conditions has been deadly.
In addition to all the other challenges I mentioned, we also lead the city in violence and homicides. Right now, homicides are up in our neighborhood and in our communities. So if that is an example of how we're coping, we're not coping well.
Back at her home in Northern Virginia, Maria Zelaya managed to keep everyone else from getting sick by pushing all six of them into the other bedroom. Her main concerns now are economic. She hasn't been working since the restaurant cut back on its hours. She can't pay the rent and worries about getting evicted. While her children are U.S. citizens, she doesn't have legal status. As a result, she isn't eligible for unemployment benefits or federal stimulus checks.
It's sad when you go to apply and they tell you you don't have a Social Security card. I'm sorry, I can't do anything for you. It's like they're shutting the door in your face. It's sad, but that's the reality we Latinos are living with.
Can you afford to not work?
No, I can't afford not to work.
Cecil Brown and Shenrika have been arguing about whether Shenrika will go back to work. The mother of three says she needs the money and has heard there are more protections in place now. But they don't want to go through this again.
We're not sure that you get it one time and that's it. So our mindset have to be now, never to get it again. That's number one.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor in Washington.
As the presidential election moves into the final stretch, we want to regularly check in on how things are playing out across the country. Tonight, we turn to Gary Abernathy. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. He's based in Ohio. And Sarah Smar, she's a Kansas-based journalist and the author of the book Heartland. Hello to both of you. You were with us for the conventions, and it's great to have you back with us again. We just heard Yamiche's report about the pandemic, the disproportionate effect on people of color. I want to start out by asking you about Bob Woodward's book, Revelations Out Today, Gary Abernathy, that the president knew in late January how serious it was. He told Woodward he knew it was much more deadly than the flu, and yet he continued to tell the public that it would go away for many weeks after that. I know it's early, this has just come out, but what's your sense of how voters where you are going to react to this?
Yeah, thanks, Judy. It's good to be with you and Sarah. I read several of the stories today about the book. I like Bob Woodward's books. I've read several of them. I look forward to this one. I don't know that there's a big contradiction like some people are saying. I know the president said early on it was a deadly situation. He did compare it to the flu. Of course, the flu can be deadly too. But I think the president's motives, you know, and the way a lot of people here will look at it, he wanted to keep the economy open. He wanted to keep things rolling. I don't think he ever really bought into shutting things down, even though eventually he kind of had to. But I think most people here who support him are going to say, yeah, we all kind of knew it was deadly, and that's not really big news. Now, others will, of course, make a case that, hey, he was hiding this, he was covering up. But I think a lot of people here will just say, you know, yes, he knew it was deadly, but he was trying to keep people calm. He didn't want to panic across the country. He wanted things to remain as normal as possible.
Of course, it also meant that he didn't take some of the sweeping steps that some say he could have taken, should have taken, arguably, if he had publicly acknowledged the severity of it. But Sarah Marsh, what about you? What about Kansas? What do you think? It's early, but what's your sense of how people may react?
Well, I agree with Gary that, you know, his existing supporters, the president's existing supporters, likely will not bail from the Trump ship over this if they haven't thus far over other controversies. So just like with data about the coronavirus, we are seeing over and over that along partisan lines, we can pretty easily predict and track the way that people will respond to news based on their party affiliation or political leanings. So while this might hold some bearing on independent and swing voters, to whatever extent they're still out there, I doubt that folks who are supporting Trump will be moved by this news.
And, I mean, there's so much else to ask you about the book, a number of other derogatory comments about the president by people high up in the administration. But I do want to move on to the economy. To however people see Gary Abernathy, where you are, the economic message coming from the president versus what they may or may not be hearing from Joe Biden. What's your sense of how people are reading that?
I think that a lot of people, again, it kind of goes back to what we talked about before, Judy. People weren't happy where I live that everything was totally shut down to begin with. They felt like a more targeted approach was necessary where there were hot spots across the country. Yes, more drastic action was needed, but to shut down everything across the Southern Ohio area, for example, where I'm at, people generally weren't very happy with it. So to say that means they gave Trump credit for the economy that existed before everything shut down for the pandemic. And I think that they believe his policies worked then. And if we can just get back up and running, they'll work again.
And Sarah, what about you? I know you talk to folks a lot, and you were sharing with us today. But tell us what you're hearing, what people are perceiving as they sense or hear the messages. What's coming through to them about the economy?
Sure. Well, I should start by saying that the state of Kansas had a kind of woefully outdated infrastructure at its Department of Labor when they were suddenly slammed by flux of historic levels of unemployment claims last spring, and they've spent, you know, every day since toiling to sort of update, restructure, and address that demand. So meanwhile, while the state is waiting for Congress to act with a renewed aid package, we recently were approved for $63 million in FEMA funds, and so I think that Kansans are aware that there's some help coming from a different revenue stream. But as far as how this relates politically to what's going on with the election and what messages are sort of landing, the economic crisis, of course, dovetails with the pandemic and people's essentially belief in or lack thereof regarding the coronavirus kind of predicts how they feel about the economy and whether Trump is doing a good job or not. So yesterday, the city of Wichita, their city council, that's our largest city in the state of Kansas, held a meeting as to whether to extend the city mask mandate. That was passed in response to the broader county revoking the governor's state-level mask mandate. There's been a lot of different jurisdictions battling here, and they're passing yay or nay on masks definitely correlates with partisan political leanings. Yesterday at that meeting, for 7 hours, anti-mask wearing sort of self-proclaimed freedom advocates who are definitely giving a line about the economy and the economic imperative to stop imposing such measures on small businesses held forth at this meeting at the microphone. I think that they are sort of a very vocal minority. Most people that I see around here think that the economy is currently a disaster and that it's absolutely related to the pandemic, but the messages about questioning the mask wearing and social distancing and the validity of numbers about the virus have definitely gotten through to a large contingent of people.
So much more that I'd love to ask you two about. We will be having you back to continue the conversation. Sarah Marsh, Gary Abernathy, we thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Finally tonight, as colleges are starting classes in new ways, online, in person, or a hybrid, a familiar question is being asked again. Is college worth it? Are there jobs on the other end? And other questions. Do you remember shop class? Do you know how to make anything with your own hands? A four-year college in Charleston, South Carolina, is connecting those dots and making its mission to teach traditional skills to carry students through life. Jeffrey Brown shows us this unusual place where students have started the year full-time in person and with no cases of COVID reported. This piece was filmed before the pandemic, and it's part of our ongoing Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
Iron and fire, not your typical college materials, but all part of the daily life of the American College of the Building Arts.
This is a student-built staircase.
Retired Lieutenant General Colby Broadwater is its president.
This school exists to fill a void in the United States. We have no one that's teaching these skills and crafts to young men and women who want to become an educated artisan.
The school, housed in a restored 1897 trolley barn, is small, under 100 students. This is a place where the president's dog is named Palladio, after the great Italian Renaissance architect.
Big day for us here in Charleston.
It's even been the focus of the popular PBS series, This Old House.
So, you're ready to install the gates today?
We sure hope so.
Part trade school, part traditional liberal arts college, it awards a Bachelor of Applied Sciences degree. Everyone is required to take a variety of science and humanities courses.
And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils.
Students choose from seven areas of concentration, including stone, plaster and brick masonry, timber framing, and architectural carpentry. The tuition, under $10,000 a semester, with 85% of students getting some kind of financial aid. But most of all, it's hands-on work, taught by master craftsmen like blacksmith Jack Brubaker.
Most often I find myself being asked, how do I something?
Something very practical.
Oftentimes, rather than say, do this, it's like, well, there's this way, and this way. Yeah. And they get a broader experience and yet choose their path.
Another requirement, architectural preservation, to study the methods and regulation of restoration. Professor Christina Ray Butler.
Trades, I know, because I went to trade school, are physically and mentally difficult. But
you went to trade school.
I did.
Yeah,
for carpentry and new construction. And then I got a degree in preservation because this school didn't exist. I would have come here because it marries two fields that have been separated.
And the setting in Charleston, Butler says, is crucial.
It is the largest historic district in the United States. So it's a great laboratory for students because we have so much protected built environment right in the heart of the city.
In fact, one particular part of Charleston's history led to this school's existence. After Hurricane Hugo battered the city in 1989, local officials and residents found there were few craftsmen in the U.S. who knew how to rebuild to proper standards. A small training program grew into a school, and by 2004, into the college. Today, it lures a mix of students. There are fresh out of high schoolers like 18-year-old Iris Howe, who's learning to carve stone. What did her friends back home in Fredericksburg, Virginia say when they heard her choice of college?
Like, what? You're stone carving? Like how they did a long time ago before they figured out how to do other stuff?
Exactly.
Like, yeah, exactly that.
This is still a largely male population, but Iris hopes more young women will get as excited as she did when she first visited.
I just saw people working with their hands and kind of creating things that would outlive them, and I thought that was really cool.
There are also older students like 31-year-old Ken McCummings, who served 8 years in the Marine Corps. A junior with a concentration in timber framing, he has two small children at home and wants to put his artistry to work for a living.
That's the beauty about the school. You dip your toes into every aspect of it. The way that craftsman used to be, the main drive for me was understanding every aspect of this industry. I can go into design work. I can be a laborer that cuts elegant joinery for a structure. I can also be the guy that's involved in every step of the process, working with the homeowner in order to complete a major project. I can go anywhere.
Clearly, this isn't for everyone. You have to like getting dusty and sweaty.
When it started off, this side right here was about 11 inches sunken down.
Even working in graveyards. Students routinely hone their craft in the community, and senior Peter Taroni was part of a team that restored box tombs in the historic Circular Congregational Church, dating to 1681. He'd attended a traditional college and decided it wasn't for him.
With younger people, I think we have a desire for, as things become more and more digital and electronic and, you know, up in the cloud, we crave things we can touch and see. And the most amazing thing about this kind of thing is once you're done with what you do, you can look at it, point to it and say, that's what I did.
The question is whether this school is a model for others. The good news here, much touted, is that every graduate comes out with a job.
It'll overlap each other and be seamless.
Wow.
As a student, Joe Wissanant helped restore this gate at a private historic home. He now works for a local iron design company.
This is a separate piece.
Having won a prestigious fellowship at a famed French workshop, he saw how artisanship and craft are valued more there.
I feel like the work over here is more based around the monetary value of it and getting, you know, the money and making it fast instead of making something that's, you know, unique and truly great.
Do you think that's changing at all?
I think it is. I feel like the school is a testament to that. That mindset of making things by hand and craftsmanship is starting to take America by storm.
As we close the gate on this story, that's quite a hope. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in Charleston, South Carolina.
Cheering on those young people. Hooray to each one of you for pursuing that. And you're all going to have a job. That's the best part of all. Separately, on the NewsHour online right now, Hurricane Laura rapidly grew from a Category 1 to a Category 4 in a day. How does storms build such intensity so fast? And what role might climate change play in increasing the likelihood of that happening? We explore that on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.